You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Senators started debate yesterday afternoon over the rules that will guide the impeachment trial of President Trump. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts is presiding over the trial. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants a swift one. Do you hope the trial wraps up quickly? Are you following this? What procedures confuse you? What witnesses and documents are you keyed in on? We're at 800-642-1234. Kim Whaley is a visiting professor and fellow in law and government at American University's Washington College of Law. Kim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Happy to be here. Good morning.
Well, catch us up as we slept. 13 hours of debate on the Senate floor. What was accomplished?
Well, we have a set of procedures that will govern the trial that are largely based on the procedures that were in place for the Clinton impeachment. Of course, there are some major differences in this process, primarily that the Clinton impeachment was based on a four-year independent counsel investigation, Ken Starr's investigation that I was part of. So there was a huge record going into that trial. Here, the rub is that there is not a big record. There was no independent counsel. There was no special prosecutor. There was no grand jury. So Democrats wanted and still want to have a process to call new witnesses and bring new evidence into the trial. And yesterday, the Senate Republicans successfully basically voted down all the motions that would have amended the rules to allow witnesses, at least at this stage.
Yeah, so the Senate rejected the amendments to subpoena records from White House, from State Department, from Defense Department and Office of Management and Budget related to the Ukraine probe. Where does that leave us with evidence then for this trial?
Yeah, so one thing that did shift was originally Mitch McConnell's first proposal would have had zero evidence, including the evidence that was developed at the House phase, and that was changed at some point by handwritten amendment that was switched to allow that evidence coming in addition to allow 3 days per side versus 2 days per side, which helps some of us not be up into the wee hours of the morning watching all of this. I think in terms of best practices, in terms of what the American people will have access to in witnessing, something of this gravity, there will not be a complete record going forward on as far as at least this point, as far as whether the president should be removed from office based on these two allegations. And clearly the Republicans, I think, are correct to the extent to which Democrats could have used the courts to force the president's hand. That being said, the president did an unprecedented stonewalling, refusal to comply at all, basically thumbing his nose at the impeachment power, which is in the Constitution six times. So the president really is largely to blame for not playing ball at all with our constitutional structure of government. And the American people are the people who lose in this, regardless of political party, because we just won't know the facts unless Democrats get four Senate Republicans to agree after the opening arguments to allow witnesses in.
So just after midnight there, President Trump's legal team exchanged really heated words with Representative Jerry Nadler, the Democratic impeachment manager. What was at the heart of this exchange?
Well, it looks like they were kind of griping at each other about matters that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court said was not germane and appropriate to the issue. And it was a rare moment in which the Chief Justice basically rebuked both sides for kind of degrading, and these are my words, the sanctity of the process. That being said, I think the Chief Justice also could step up a little more and to ensure that what actually is said in the chamber is accurate, that the process is fair, that the process he does under the Constitution have the power to preside over the trial. That's not defined. So he could take a more active role, arguably, in allowing this to actually be a trial. A trial involves evidence. The Constitution references trials twice more, at least in the Sixth Amendment right to criminal trials and the Seventh Amendment right to civil trials, and mentions witnesses in the Sixth Amendment. So the framers assume trials would have evidence. I think Chief Justice Roberts showed that he is going to be an umpire in that moment and not allow sort of griping. But the bigger question really is, is he going to take a more active role to ensure that the process is thorough? And it looks like at this moment, the answer is no.
Yeah, because right now it's more of a ceremonial role, it looks like, with the Chief Justice there.
Right. He's sort of reading pieces of paper that are put in front of him and banging the gavel to basically, kind of confirm the political decisions by the majority party. And some of us constitutional scholars are a little concerned about this because the framers did not anticipate political parties. And we're, this is about Democrats versus Republicans. And what's getting lost is the structure of oversight that the Constitution set up for the office of the presidency, not just Donald Trump. And you arguably just Chief Justice Roberts, could be more affirmative in setting the rules for his own courtroom. But we're not seeing that so far. And, I fear that the impeachment process itself will just become illegitimate going forward. And then we have to ask ourselves, what is the check on the presidency? Because even if you're a supporter of Donald Trump, he won't always be in office. There will be someone in office most of us don't like, and we can't turn to impeachment in the future as a meaningful check on the presidency. And the framers are really worried about that.
We're speaking with Kim Whaley. She's a visiting professor and fellow in law and government at American University. Your thoughts on the impeachment trial in the Senate, 800-642-1234. Kim, you're really concerned that all the relevant facts are not being put forth in the Senate. What more should the Senate know, and how could they obtain that information as we're seeing, the amendments being rejected?
Yeah, so I did a piece in an online magazine called The Bulwark this week that basically traces all of the evidence that has come out since the December 20th vote on the articles of impeachment that's come out through other sources. We have Freedom of Information Act requests that a federal judge basically required the Office of Management and Budget to respond to. We know from emails that the decision to withhold the aid was just 90 minutes after the July 25th phone call. We know from documents that were released through Lev Parnas's lawyers getting the authorization of a federal judge. They've been in the coffers of DOJ since October because of a raid on Lev Parnas, who is a former Giuliani associate who's under indictment for campaign finance violations in the Southern District of New York. We know that there were top-level officials involved in the freezing of the aid in the Ukraine, the pressure campaign against Ukraine, including arguably Attorney General Barr, Devin Nunes in the House Republican side, the House Intelligence Committee Minority Chair Mick Mulvaney, numerous officials that should really be called to testify, because if the issue really on the table factually is why did the president do this? Was it because of corruption, rooting out corruption, or was it to basically sway the next election? Then people who had firsthand knowledge should testify. And if those people say, listen, I'll confirm the president really cared about Ukrainian corruption, then that should be good for Trump. And I think it's a fair question. If there's so much pressure to not bring these witnesses forward, what would they say? And if they'd say something that would raise eyebrows with the American public deserves to hear that, because this is really about election security, the sanctity of our elections, and election security is national security. And Republicans have made the argument that impeachment undermines an election and that senators shouldn't make that determination. But the flip side is, the concern is, well, should Russia make that determination? Should other countries that are infiltrating our electoral system, according to Robert Mueller, be making that determination? And some of us would argue the impeachment clause is a better way of a kind of, quote, taking an election away from Americans because it's in the Constitution than is Russian interference. And that is ongoing. And Donald Trump has welcomed it.
Kim,
that's the new normal.
Kim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Kim Whaley, visiting professor at American University. You hear her on the Ideas Network. We're looking at tech innovations on the horizon in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Brookings Institution came out with a paper last month identifying Madison as a hotspot for tech. There's a proposal in Congress to put millions of dollars a year in research and development in metro areas where tech is taking off, especially here in the Midwest. So how has technology changed your life? How has it helped you overcome a problem or make a task easier? Do you work for a tech startup? How is it going? Are you getting the support you need to grow your firm in Wisconsin? Will you stay? We're at 800-642-1234. Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. It's a science and technology policy advisory board to the governor and legislature. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you, Kate. It's great to be back.
Where does Wisconsin fit in with the emerging technology market that you see happening here in the Midwest?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think it's a great fit. Wisconsin is not a one-trick pony when it comes to technology. You know, a lot of people think of us as a state that is really deep in the life sciences, you know, therapeutics, diagnostics, imaging, all of that. But at the same time, we're a state that's great in software, in gaming, in advanced manufacturing, in robotics, in what I would call sustainable technologies. I think we're really good across the board, which helps in this setting right now. And there's a lot of attention on the Midwest. You mentioned the Brookings Institution report, which took a deep dive into what's happening across the region and pretty much everywhere in the middle sections of the country. And Wisconsin came out well. I mean, Madison was listed number one in all of its cities as potential growth centers in the country.
Well, potential growth centers, I mean, you still have Silicon Valley and you have the San Francisco and you have a lot of that investment and angel investment pushing to your coasts. How do you gather that up and pluck it in the Midwest and say, you know what, company, startup, you should stay here?
Absolutely. That's a lot of where we try to do work. Yeah, it's true. 80% of the venture capital in the United States is clustered in either California, Massachusetts, or New York. And the other 20% is the rest of us. And so I think we do that by pointing out that we do have a diverse tech economy. We have a lot of attributes here around quality of life. We have a great workforce. And we have lower costs of business. And you know, there are parts of the valley, for example, now that are so crowded, so congested, the housing costs are high, transportation is really difficult, that we're seeing a lot of interest from investors and others there.
You see a draw on quality of life.
Yeah, you know, yeah, that's a part of it, but also the quality of the research that happens here, the quality of the workforce, all of that adds up to make the Midwest in general, and I think Wisconsin and Madison and Milwaukee in particular, great places to be.
Tech likes to cluster with each other. They like to grow up around each other.
Yes.
Do you see clusters happening in Wisconsin?
Oh, sure. And it's a fairly recent phenomenon. Like when we launched the Tech Council, you know, 18 years ago, something like that, there wasn't as much activity. I mean, you know, that's for sure. It was more clustered in some specific things like the life sciences. Today, we do see clusters not only geographically, Madison, Milwaukee, parts of the Fox Valley, parts of the Chippewa Valley, other places around the state where there's a lot more critical mass than there ever used to be. And we also see it in certain industries. I mentioned life sciences. Health IT is a really strong cluster in Wisconsin for a variety of reasons. We see it in gaming. We see it in water. So there are a variety of things in Wisconsin that really help draw people and ideas here.
We're talking with Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. You can join in. What new technology do you love using and can't live without? What new tech do you question in our world? How has technology changed your community, changed your life? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Here in the Midwest, Tom, infrastructure is always an issue. Do we have the speedy enough broadband in place? Do we have the workers in place to fill these jobs in rural areas? How is technology working to solve those problems in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and in Wisconsin, and that's a part of the, you know, what we work on as a tech council a lot is thinking about what's the infrastructure look like. Broadband in Wisconsin has gotten better. It's still not where it needs to be in every part of the state. There's no doubt about that. But it's so important to the economy as well as the way of life. Good Main Street businesses might remain Main Street businesses, except for the fact that they could actually be out on the internet and selling everywhere. And we've seen examples of that around Wisconsin. So I think that's a that really holds a lot of promise for rural Wisconsin, as does telemedicine, which is oftentimes the best way to reach people. And some health systems in Wisconsin have gotten very good at that. It's also important to reach out to people in some other ways. Education is another great example. It is better, and Wisconsin is going to see more around 5G technologies in the coming years, and I think that's important as well.
So, what would that mean? What would that entail?
I think that's going to entail faster, faster access to the internet, up and down, both downloads and uploads, and it's going to be, I think, really something that can help in all parts of Wisconsin as it rolls out. It'll probably start in urban areas first just because of density, but I think it can move into the rural areas fairly soon.
One of the fears of technology is automation, the robotics, the artificial intelligence, factory jobs turning into jobs by robots. And we've been looking at specifically at Foxconn with that and whether those will be humans doing those jobs. How is tech grappling with that, with automation?
Well, and as you well know, Wisconsin's a leading manufacturing state. You know, if you look at the workforce and the productivity and everything else, Wisconsin's one of the top three states, depending on how you count it. All manufacturers are today going to be more automated. I mean, that's as simple as it is. But automation and robotics are going to ultimately create as many jobs as they might take away. They're really a way of making sure that that productivity remains in place and putting people into jobs that are at times more challenging, but at the same time are going to be more rewarding. So I'm actually optimistic about that because Wisconsin, because of its manufacturing base, because of its manufacturing legacy, is a state that's going to be able to embrace robotics and automation more than others. In fact, a lot of robotics began here. And if, in fact, it began in some places like in the auto industry with roots in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. So we've been a pioneer in that. I can see how people think in the short term it could cause some problems, but I think in the long term it's going to create a lot of jobs.
Well, let's go to Gary now in Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Yes. Investors and the tech companies in general made the whole San Francisco area unaffordable for normal people and actually made it a worse place to try to live. If I understand what Mr. Still is saying, he's saying now he wants those same people to come here and do the same thing to the Midwest. Madison is already not affordable for the average person. I just can't see that this is such a wonderful thing.
Gary, thank you for the call. Tom, how would you respond to that?
Investors invest close to home. They don't often reach out in other places. So the fact that it's probably not realistic to think that hordes of investors from the Silicon Valley are going to come here. Some will to take a look at things, but they're probably not going to uproot the entire operation. And it's not just investors who make things either livable or unlivable. It's the rest of the ecosystem as well. Wisconsin has a really strong base of investors at the angel and venture level. It's not what it is in other states, but it's getting better all the time. So that's one of the things, again, that we spend some time on. When we started our Tech Council Investors Network 2004, there were maybe a half dozen investor groups we could point to. Today, there are about 36. So there's a lot going on right here with investors who understand this state and this region who are doing great things.
As we wrap up here, what is the biggest challenge then as you look at Wisconsin as a whole as it tries to build up a tech sector?
I think the biggest challenge is almost always going to be workforce and people and, you know, just talent in general. I think most of the Western world, if not beyond, is encountering a demographic crunch, you know, not enough people of a certain age to fill all of the jobs.
And Wisconsin is aging itself.
Yes, absolutely. We are not immune from that at all. So I think over time, making sure that we attract and retain people from elsewhere, but also those who are tied to Wisconsin, those who may have grown up here, those who went to school here, those who want to come back. You know, it gets us back to the question of the coast. There are a lot of people from the Silicon Valley who maybe have Wisconsin or Midwest ties who would like to be here. We welcome them back. I think that there are a lot of opportunities in Wisconsin.
Tom, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Kate.
Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Coming up, we look at the 47th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Our guest explains the far-reaching legal legacy of the decision and where the Supreme Court stands today on abortion. That's coming up right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And a quick programming note, the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump resumes today at noon. You can hear live NPR coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio's News and Classical Network and online at WPR.org. Here on the Ideas Network, we'll keep you updated on the latest and we'll invite you to join the conversation. Right now, we're talking about Roe versus Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion 47 years ago. In March, the High Court will hear its first major abortion rights case since the confirmations of Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. Observers on both sides of this fraught debate say this is the year. This is the year when everything could change for abortion rights. Do you have an opinion about Roe versus Wade and what was argued decades ago? How do you think the case has impacted what you see in legislation coming out of states today? We're at 800-642-1234. Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law, where she specializes in the legal history of reproduction. Her third book on abortion history and law is due out in March. Mary, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Where does the High Court stand today? Because since the 2016 presidential campaign, there's been this speculation that we're going to see a more and more conservative Supreme Court and that overturning Roe is just a matter of time. What do you say to that?
I think that's right. I think that the current court has a majority that's been selected in part with the goal being to see Roe overturned. And the people who are in the business of selecting Supreme Court justices for that reason are quite good at their jobs. So we've been surprised in the past. In the early 1990s, everyone expected Roe to be overturned, and everyone was wrong. So you can never be sure until the moment comes. But I think it's reasonable to expect that Roe being overturned is a question of not if, but when.
Would it be one major overturning, or do you see nips and tucks along the way as states make changes within the state that they can about abortion rights?
I think it's much more likely to be a gradual process. The justices who are on the Supreme Court care about the court's reputation and image. And if you could overturn, you know, decades worth of precedent simply by changing the membership of the court, and if that only took a year, that would definitely make the court look more partisan and political than judicial and neutral. So I think you'd be much more likely to see a kind of death by a thousand cuts when you're thinking of Roe v. Wade or abortion rights rather than one single decision. Although there may come a moment down the road when the court quite clearly does announce that there are no more federal constitutional abortion rights.
Roe undid all state laws that made abortion illegal. If Roe is overturned, what would that mean in practice on the state level?
Well, the court has already modified Roe in 1992 and allowed states more room to regulate abortion, but the state still can't impose what the court calls an undue burden on abortion. So obviously things like bans on abortion early in pregnancy would be unconstitutional. If Roe is gone, that would open the door to much more sweeping bans on abortion. And really, too, I think a debate on what states can ban when they say they're banning abortion, including things like what some might consider abortifacient contraceptives or even assisted reproductive technologies. So we'd be talking about some states likely banning abortion outright and imposing pretty serious criminal penalties. And if you want a preview of what that might look like, you can look at what some states have already introduced in terms of laws used to test Roe, like what you saw in 2019 in Alabama or Georgia.
What happened in Alabama and Georgia?
Alabama introduced a law banning abortion at fertilization with no exceptions for rape and incest. And the law, at least as it was framed, didn't include punishments for women or pregnant people, but did authorize, I think it was up to 99 years in prison for doctors who perform abortion. Georgia's was what was called a heartbeat law, so banned abortion on the theory that fetal cardiac activity or a heartbeat could be detected at 6 weeks. And at that point, the state also recognized fetal personhood for a whole variety of purposes, not just abortion. So those laws would be quite different from what you see, even though there are lots of abortion restrictions now. They don't go nearly that far and don't criminalize all or most abortions.
We're talking with Mary Ziegler. She's a professor at Florida State University College of Law, an expert on the legal history of abortion in America. What questions do you have about the current Supreme Court justices and their stance on Roe versus Wade? Do you have an opinion about how the case was argued? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mary, when you're watching legislation coming out of these states, do you find patterns? Do you find similarities in how the legislation is written and what is at stake in each of these states?
Absolutely. I mean, I think on both sides, on both the pro-choice and pro-life side, we're very much looking at national campaigns. There's very little in any state that's just sort of organic and local. On the pro-life or anti-abortion side, really what you're seeing is kind of a strategic debate. So one side of that debate wants to kind of go for the home run, if you will, and force the Supreme Court to reconsider Roe immediately by introducing these much more sweeping laws like a heartbeat bill, for example. The other side of the strategic debate wants to take the death of a thousand cuts road on the theory that that's much more likely to work with the current Supreme Court. And also on the theory that that would be much more go over better with the public, because voters, the theory would go, are not ready for or interested in an outright abortion ban with no exceptions for rape and incest. So I think in the states, the pattern you see would be kind of those two strategies unfolding. So some states like Tennessee are planning to ban all abortions, for example, that's on the table, while other states are doing something much more incremental, like banning specific abortion techniques like abortion pills or specific abortion methods, or, you know, laws like these abortion reversal laws, which force patients or doctors to make statements that medication abortions can be reversed. So you would expect to see the states kind of lining up in those two strategic camps in 2020.
Let's zoom in on this abortion case the Supreme Court is slated to hear this year. That's Gee versus June. That's out of Louisiana. The case relates to a law in Louisiana that's similar to one in Texas that would limit the number of abortion providers in the state. Can you help us understand what is being argued here and what each side is saying?
Sure. So part of the reason this is an important case is because it'll give us some insight into how the court feels about abortion precedent writ large. So the court, as you mentioned, in 2016 had struck down a law pretty much exactly like this Louisiana law that required doctors to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of an abortion clinic. So in part, the question could simply be, are the facts on the ground in Louisiana different enough from the facts in Texas, which was where the 2016 case happened? You could make it as narrow as that, but there's obviously a possibility that the court could overrule its 2016 decision, which seemed to make the rules regarding abortion rights much more protective than they had been before. The other issue in the case is, it seems like a technical one, but it has a lot of significance, which is who can sue to argue that abortion laws are unconstitutional in the first place. Louisiana is arguing that abortion doctors shouldn't be allowed to bring lawsuits on behalf of their patients anymore. on the theory that abortion doctors don't act in their patients' best interest. Essentially, they're acting for reasons of profit, and that that's particularly true when the laws, in theory, are claimed to protect patients' health. That could be significant if the court agrees with it for two reasons. Practically, it would make it much harder for anyone to challenge abortion laws. As you can imagine, it's hard for pregnant patients to bring these lawsuits because they're not as experienced with the legal system, because their pregnancies don't go on indefinitely, and because pregnancy is a difficult experience. It would also have a kind of send a powerful message about where the court may be going when it comes to Roe, because if the court accepts the idea that abortion doctors don't act in women's best interests, they'll be implicitly accepting the idea that abortion may not be good for patients or for women, which is the cornerstone of a strategy to reverse Roe v. Wade.
Geographically speaking, and what you're seeing on the ground, how is Planned Parenthood responding as you look at access to abortion?
Well, but Planned Parenthood, I think, is already in some ways planning for the possibility that Roe will in fact be overturned, and is building larger clinics in states that are going to be more protective of abortion. Because so far, we've mostly been focusing on the response of states that are going to restrict or ban abortion. But other states that are more pro-choice have been acting preemptively to expand abortion rights. And Planned Parenthood has been part of that in the sense that they're building clinics with greater capacity on the assumption that patients from neighboring states may be traveling there to get abortion services if their own states no longer make them available.
So you would see women crossing state lines in order to get those services, to get that abortion, or perhaps driving hundreds of miles.
Sure. I mean, I think that the two ways you would expect to see this breakdown would either be women driving to get, or even flying if they had the resources to get abortion services. And you would also expect to see a spread in kind of self-induced or self-managed abortion, especially because of the wide availability of abortion pills, right? I mean, you can get them, certainly now you are supposed to be getting them with a prescription and under doctor's care, but there are NGOs and as well as private providers that sell abortion pills online. So that might be what a post-Roe world looks like. And it will raise, I think, interesting and difficult questions for legislators who are opposed to abortion about whether they're going to punish women, simply because if you pass an abortion ban and all women need to do to evade it is leave the state or buy a pill online, your abortion ban's not going to do a whole lot unless the state decides to crack down on women too. So in the long term, we may be having a debate about not just if abortion is going to be punished, but who these states choose to punish when they criminalize abortion.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law, where she researches abortion law. Your thoughts here, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. On this 47th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, we're taking stock. Last year, 17 states enacted some type of abortion restriction. 9 states protected or expanded abortion access. By the end of 2019, 25 new abortion bans had been signed into law, this tally by the Guttmacher Institute. How do you think Roe has affected abortion legislation at the state level? Still time, 800-642-1234. Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law. Let's take a call now. Mike is joining us from Madison. Good morning, Mike.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. Question for your guest, Mary. How would state laws affect Native American Indian tribal lands? Could not abortion providers set up on tribal land? And then also just off the coast of Florida, the Gulf of Mexico, could not abortion providers set up on in waters that are just outside of the U.S. Jurisdiction?
Mike, go ahead, sorry.
No, you go ahead, Mary. Jump right in.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, tribal laws, tribal lands rather, are subject to federal law, so and state law as well. There would, if that happened, there would be interesting, I think, both jurisdictional questions, so questions about who got to decide and whose laws applied, if tribes chose to take that step. And I think that that problem would unfold really across states as well, because you could imagine, let's just take Missouri and Illinois, right? Missouri is very restrictive of abortion, would likely ban abortion. Illinois is very pro-choice. There would be similar fights about, for example, if Missouri wanted to put on trial a doctor who was performing abortions in Illinois, which courts would get to decide and whose laws would apply. I think you would see that kind of scenario unfold in either of the kind of hypotheticals your guest mentioned. If you either had somebody performing abortions offshore or performing abortions on tribal land, or really even when it comes to crossing state boundaries or national boundaries. There are NGOs that operate out of the United Kingdom and Canada that are interested in providing medication abortion to patients who can't access it, or in countries where abortion is illegal. There could even be questions about whose laws apply from an international standpoint. So it would be messy, to say the least.
Mike, thanks for the call. Mary, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has said she thinks the court should have treated abortion more like it treated gender equality cases, more incrementally. And she thinks Roe went too far, made state rights an issue. Is there other scholarship around this? Do other scholars feel this way?
Yeah, I think that there are kind of two interesting points that Justice Ginsburg made. One is that a lot of scholars, both pro-choice and pro-life, don't find Roe's reasoning particularly convincing. And they find what they see lots of problems with it. One, that the court described a right to privacy without really finding any or clear, obvious justification for it in the text or history of the Constitution. Some feminist scholars didn't like the fact that Roe seemed to focus more on the rights of doctors than on equality for women. So it's certainly true that many scholars have argued that Roe would have been more convincing had it relied on ideas about sex discrimination, and potentially if the court had proceeded more incrementally. I think historically that's true, that it would have been more convincing, but there's a separate question about whether the abortion debate would have been any less polarized, or whether anti-abortion Americans would have been any more satisfied if Roe had reached the same result eventually on a different rationale. And just as someone who studies this, I'm very skeptical of that. The underlying dispute in the abortion debate really isn't about Roe. If you're pro-life or anti-abortion, it's about the idea that abortion is murder and that there's a right to life. And so I think that unless the court had not recognized a right to abortion at all, or potentially even not recognized a right to life, we would still be seeing a pretty intense conflict, maybe incrementally less intense if Justice Ginsburg's vision had come true. But I don't see that as a kind of way out of the dysfunctional conversation we've been having for the past several decades.
We only have a few seconds left, but what are you keeping a close eye on?
Well, certainly on the Supreme Court decision, I think even if we don't see Roe being overturned, we're likely to see something major happening. And I think it's also worth it for listeners to pay attention to the less splashy incremental restrictions that are going to be coming up in state legislatures this year, because it's just as likely that those will be the way that abortion rights come to an end than it is something more attention-getting, like an absolute ban.
Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law. Her third book on abortion law is due out in March. In the last two decades, dozens of Wisconsin school districts have retired their Native American mascots. As the statewide Association of School Boards considers the issue this week, a Native American man who portrayed his school's mascot more than 50 years ago says it's time to put an end to all such images. Rob Mentzer has more.
Of all the images of Native Americans in the Bittersweet Winds exhibit, the mascot suit stands out. It's 6.5 feet tall with bright red skin and features so exaggerated that it barely looks human.
We call him Wolfman. And to me, this is the most racist item in the exhibit.
Richie Plass is the curator of this exhibit, and this showing at the Shawnee Community High School is a homecoming for him. In 1968, when Richie was 16, the school principal here asked him to dress up and perform as the school's Indian mascot. It would be the beginning for him of decades of thought and activism about representations of Native Americans. That winter, Richie, who is Menominee and Stockbridge Muncie, went to talk to a tribal elder who offered this advice.
If they want a Hollywood Indian, give them a Hollywood Indian. Don't wear anything sacred.
So Richie borrowed a fake feather headdress.
I had made in Japan moccasins. My little necklace thing was plastic. I even had a rubber tomahawk, you know.
He performed at two home games. The crowd cheered for him. People from the reservation were there to support him. It felt good. Then Richie went with the team to an away game. This time, when he ran out into the gym, people shouted insults.
And then I can specifically remember orange peels, banana peels, and paper cups being thrown at me. Now I back way up. And that's when the guys on the top row start spitting on me. And I just ran into the locker room.
Richie was in tears. The whole experience, he says now, shows the psychological toll the use of Native American mascots can take. By their nature, they reduce people to stereotypes. He says that's why he's still working on this issue 50 years later. And in Wisconsin, that work has recently picked up some momentum. When Washington's NFL team came to Green Bay in December, a group of protesters greeted them at Lambeau Field with drumming and chanting. They carried signs that said, "Redskins equals racial slur," and "Race-based mascots must go." One member of the group, 14-year-old Isabella Saiz, directly addressed the team's owner, Dan Snyder.
Why do you still believe that this is something that is good for the Native people all around the world? Why do you continue to ignore us when we speak out against it?
The Washington football team is among the most high-profile teams to use a Native American mascot, but there are hundreds of teams across the country that employ Native imagery, including dozens at school districts in Wisconsin. Barbara Munson, who was at the Lambeau Field protest, has been pushing to eliminate Native American mascots since 1997.
Since that time, we've seen 36 Indian mascots change in the state of Wisconsin, and that's really good, but there's still 29 left.
Munson's message to those districts is simple.
Really, it's time for change.
This week, the Wisconsin Association of School Boards is considering a resolution that would call on all Wisconsin school districts to retire their Native American mascots. The resolution was created by WASA School Board President Tricia Zunker. Zunker, who is also running for Congress as a Democrat, cites research showing psychological and educational harm to both Native and non-Native students. And she says the issue affects students in all districts, even those that don't have Native mascots themselves.
It still does affect their perception. It affects their educational experience outside of the classroom.
Plass has seen progress on the issue. Shawnee changed its mascot more than 25 years ago. But he says seeing Native Americans as full human beings means retiring all such mascots.
We're alive. I'm sitting here talking to you. We're a living culture.
The Wisconsin Association of School Boards is taking up the resolution at its annual convention. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us for The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.